The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, a common lizard in the American West plays a unique game of rock, paper, scissors. And your dog may be smarter than you think. A new study finds some dogs can learn by eavesdropping. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Rock, paper, lizards? Commonly found in American deserts, side-blotched lizards exhibit a unique behavior similar to rock, paper, scissors. But these animals aren't throwing hand signs. Male lizards display a color on their necks that is associated with their behavior. Whether the animal has yellow, blue, or orange coloring is related to how the lizards seek females to reproduce. To learn more, I spoke with Ammon Coral, a postdoctoral researcher at the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at UC Berkeley.
I got interested in them because of work from my PhD advisor, Barry Sinervo, and he had worked out that they play a biological version of a rock-paper-scissors game. So this is kind of surprising and is a really cool story that has kind of made these lizards famous. So how the rock, paper, scissors game works in the side-blotched lizard is that there's if you turn the lizards over and you look at their throats, there's three different throat color morphs, as we call them. So there's orange-throated males, there's blue-throated males, and there's yellow-throated males. And they compete with each other. And so, and they're competing for access to females and territories. And so how the rock, paper, scissors game works in terms of this is that the males with blue throats, they closely guard the females on their territories to keep other males from mating with them. However, the males with orange throats can take territory from the blue-throated males and because they have more testosterone and higher endurance levels. And so they're physically able to kind of take over this territory. And as a result, the orange males, they can control large females with lots of territories. And then the last type is the yellow-throated males. They don't defend a territory. Instead, they sneak onto the territories that are defended by other males to gain access to the females there. And this sneaking strategy works well on the large territories of orange males, which are naturally hard to defend because they're large, but not so well on the smaller territories of blue males that guard their mates. And so as a result, the orange males can beat blue males, and the yellow males can beat orange males, and the blue males can beat yellow males, just like we would imagine for a rock, paper, scissors game. And so this kind of fascinated me early on and led me to join Barry Sinervo's lab to study this system further.
It almost sounds like a playground game. You know, I'm going to be, you know, king of the mountain and you're going to try and sneak up from this side. And it's remarkable to hear how these lizards actually interact. Can they actually see each other's color when this kind of behavior is going on?
Absolutely. The color signals for the lizards on their throats are not for humans because they're actually trying to hide them from predators and things like that. That's why they're on the underside of their bodies. They're using those colors to display to each other to kind of advertise, hey, I'm controlling this territory or things like that. And so they very much cue into the colors. In terms of the playground, I mean, we can recognize commonalities here because, like, if you're trying to defend some area in the playground, there can be a variety of different tactics for doing that. You can be sneaky, you can be really strong and fast, or you can kind of, like, you know, be more close and guarded. And so we kind of instantly recognize that maybe, you know, these are kind of good strategies that might be kind of universal as things you could try.
So what actually determines the colors that these lizards will inherit? Are they born into these colors of orange, blue, or yellow?
So that was the thing that I wanted to figure out in the latest study that I have been working on. And we now have kind of genetic sequencing technologies that are capable of figuring this out in a random lizard out in the environment, which allowed us to figure out what's the genetic system behind these rock, paper, scissors morphs. And so after a lot of genetic work, it turns out that it's actually somewhat simple. So it turns out that basically there's two major genetic differences at one single gene. And this gene is called C-peptin reductase, which you can kind of abbreviate to SPR for short. And it turns out that basically the orange morphs have one genetic type. They have two chromosomes with what I call the orange haplotype. And in contrast, the blue and yellow types have at least one chromosome that's carrying the blue haplotype or the blue allele. And so as a result, basically the orange ones are genetically distinct from the blue and yellow ones. Now this leads to the question is, what's going on that differentiates blue and yellow morphs? Well, it turns out they're genetically similar and their differences arise not because of genetic differences, but because they can alter their phenotype depending on their environment. So basically males that can't acquire a territory, they express that yellow coloration and they sneak around. But if the males are able to get a territory, they express blue coloration and they guard their mates. And basically this flexibility lets, you know, them have two different phenotypes, and which you can imagine is beneficial for a rock, paper, scissors game. If you're kind of locked into one strategy, that can make it so that sometimes you're beaten in a rock, paper, scissors game. So they actually have some flexibility here, which is interesting.
So have you ever encountered any of these lizards, say if it's a blue changing to a yellow or a yellow changing to a blue, is there a green in between?
There's not a green in between, but the colors build up over time. So there can be lizards with kind of a pure yellow throat across their whole throat. But actually the most common type of sneaker is one where there's yellow over a lot of the throat, but they have a kind of a tiny bit of blue. So you can see that they have the ability of making that blue color, and it's just that they'll make much more of it when they get a territory. And it also seems like, from what's observed in the field, that they can only go one way. So they don't have maximum flexibility. You can go from a yellow to a blue type, but as far as we know, you can't go back. So there's something hormonally that changes in the lizard to be like, I'm going to show this blue coloration. I'm going to become a territory defender. And that's it. I think that if they had flexibility that went both ways, it would probably just mean that the blue type would take over the population. But instead, they're kind of like have this developmental choice.
Is there a difference in the coloration and the vividness of the coloring between a female lizard and a male lizard?
Oh, that's a great question. So there are differences between males and females, especially in the population where this work took place. So the blue coloration in the females is very hard to see, if at all. So the females have actually been characterized as basically having orange versus yellow throats. And we still need to work out the genetics behind that. But what I suspect is it still is going to correspond to either you making orange pigment or not. But that's kind of something that we're going to work on going forward.
Now, because there is a genetic difference between the orange morph versus the yellow or blue, when the lizards couple up, essentially, can the orange lizards reproduce with yellow or blue lizards or vice versa? How does the combination shake out in this playground game of rock, paper, scissors that we're speaking about?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a good question, because the males are competing for access to females. So from the female side of things, they actually are a player in this game as well, and they will mate with actually multiple different males, and they probably have their own interests in mind. And so there is some theory that would suggest that who would the females want to mate with? It would be whichever male color type is kind of rare, because the next year those ones are probably going to have a high fitness. So that's one of the things that we want to look at. But we do know that basically females do tend to choose like males that have a good territory because that's going to be where they like to lay their eggs. But there were some interesting experiments in the past where they actually manipulated the territories of males by basically moving rocks from one territory to another to kind of increase how good they were. And the females followed the rocks and went to the good territories, but they'd still mate with some of the males that were like potentially more attractive.
So what fascinates you about this research? Obviously, it's a colorful display and it's something that I've never heard of before. But it's got to be thrilling sort of watching this behavior play out in such a unique sort of small scale in the natural environment.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a fun story to imagine that, you know, there's this biological form of rock, paper, scissors happening out in nature. But I think that there's actually kind of a larger reason why this is interesting is that lots of animals are competing with each other for a variety of reasons. And oftentimes when we imagine competition, you imagine there's going to be like two types competing and one outcompetes the other. And then you kind of wind up with just one single type. And so this is why the rock, paper, scissors game has actually interested people in biology and theorists for a long time, is because it's a really simple way of saying even with competitive dynamics, you can maintain multiple types either in a population or you can maintain multiple species in an environment. And so basically this idea that like you have a competitor that is good in certain circumstances when it's competing against like if rocks good against scissors, but it's loses against paper, that kind of dynamic means that you can maintain multiple types in the population. And so that's where I think my work kind of plays into that larger theme of how do we get kind of biodiversity maintained in the environment.
And Ammon, where will your research take you next? What else are you going to explore?
Oh, there's a lot of ways I want to take this forward. So one is kind of we've already touched on is kind of the female side of things that needs to be explored more, and kind of the mechanisms that basically are maintaining the variation in the population. But I think there's two other themes here that I think are particularly interesting is that one is it's always been kind of a puzzle to me is how do these morphs develop their phenotypes because you have a color signal on their throat that also corresponds to a behavioral difference. And so one of the things that's come out of my research is that this C-preapnin reductase gene has kind of two functions in the body. Is that one, it makes color pigments, like oranges and yellows and stuff like that. It's involved in making color pigments. But at the same time, it's also expressed in the brain. It's actually a gene that's found across a variety of vertebrates, and it's known to basically play a role in making neurotransmitters and hormones. And so one of the things that I think would be really interesting to study going forward is we can study the variation in this gene in the lizards potentially as a way of working at better what this C-preapnin reductase gene is doing in the body and how it might have kind of interesting effects on behavior. And so that's one of the things that I think would be really interesting to look at.
Well, best of luck in your research, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me about this. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, thank you. I appreciate the chance to get to talk more about it.
Ammon Coral is a postdoctoral researcher at the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at UC Berkeley. His research is published in the journal Science. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. A new study has found some dogs may be as smart as a human toddler. Researchers have found dogs have the ability to associate words with objects, even if they're not spoken to directly. In other words, man's best friend may be eavesdropping. The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with Shani Dror, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Veterinary Medicine in Vienna, to learn more.
So people always ask me about how smart are dogs. And I think it's important to recognize that different species have different strengths. And while dogs maybe don't have very good motor or spatial cognition, so they're not, you know, a lot of us know the funny situation of a dog getting stuck in the door with a stick because the stick is too big. So they're not so good at these things. But what they really excel at is in social cognition. And they're really, really good in reading human communicative cues and picking up on very small things that humans do and even humans are not aware of. In general, we see some breeds that were specifically bred to work with humans, and these breeds are normally very motivated. So they really like food, they really like play, they pay a lot of attention to humans. And some of these are herding breeds, some of these are dogs that were bred for hunting. So we see these abilities more, but it's hard to say if these dogs are, you know, if their social cognition is better, or is it just that they're more motivated to do what we're asking them to do? You know, cats are very smart, but they often just don't care what you're asking them to do.
Also, to kind of just establish what we're talking about, the study also looks at toddlers. So I'm wondering, are toddlers particularly smart, or there's a lot that happens for them, I think, between those toddler years where they're learning a lot in a short amount of time. So I'm just wondering, in comparison, just how smart are they when they, you know, enter the world and learning all these new things as well?
So we didn't compare directly with toddlers. We didn't test any toddlers in this study, but we did look at studies that have tested toddlers and what abilities they found. And I think it's important to note that toddlers are developing. They're developing very fast. And what they can't do today, they will be able to do tomorrow and some. And a lot of the times, I also briefly worked at a lab that works with toddlers. And a lot of the time, the kids come to the lab and they, you know, they haven't slept properly or they haven't eaten or things like that. And that really interferes with their ability to do whatever task you're asking them to do. On the other hand, the dogs that we work with, they're adults. They are super motivated to do what you're asking them because all they want to do is play with their toys. They're really focused on the task. They can do this for hours. So in that sense, it's very hard to compare the two because they're just in very different stages in their lives.
So I would love to know how you conducted your study into dogs' intelligence.
So specifically, what we wanted to understand here is how dogs are perceiving human communication when it's not intended to them. We know that kids are able to learn from overhearing, and I'm sure that a lot of parents know this awkward situation where you realize your kid has learned a word they were not supposed to learn just by listening to other people speak. And that's because toddlers, when they're already a year and a half old, they can equally learn well when they're listening to someone speak and when someone is directly teaching them. So we wanted to see, what about dogs? And I'm sure that a lot of dog owners know this situation where your dog is kind of following you around the house and listening and paying a lot of attention to what you're doing. And I was like wondering, okay, what's going on in your mind? The thing is that while most dogs can easily learn things like sit or down or stay, we find that learning object names, so for example, rope, ring, ball, that's something that only a very small group of dogs are able to do. So in this study, we specifically worked with these gifted word learner dogs that can learn the names of objects to see if they are able to learn the names of objects when they're eavesdropping on their owners.
So in your study, specifically, I think it's called label learning. So I'd love for you to kind of go into depth about label learning and the difference from, like you said, a command like sit or stay. And, you know, what sort of dogs, what breeds have a knack for that label learning as well?
So it seems to be that dogs can easily learn what we call a discriminative stimuli. So this is a stimuli that tells the dog, now you can do this and you will be reinforced for it. For example, if I say sit, this discriminates that when you will sit now, you will get food for it. And dogs can easily learn this. But what they are struggling, most of them, to do is to understand that in the same situation, sometimes I'm going to ask you to get the ball, and sometimes I might be asking you to get the rope. And that is something that most dogs are really having trouble with. And we see that the dogs that are able to do this, yes, many of them are border collies, but even among border collies, this is a very rare ability. And there are also some dogs that are not border collies and can do this. So in previous studies, we had a Pekingese, we had a Shih Tzu. We know of a bunch of Yorkshire Terriers that can do this. Of course, mixed breeds. So it's not a specific border collie trait.
So essentially, dogs, or at least the ones that you looked at in your study, were able to pick up a name of an object, like a toy, for example, without their owner giving them like any engagement, meaning like not looking at them, saying like you have to sit, and like sort of that reinforcement thing that you were talking about, but rather overhearing. So do you know possibly what cues the dogs could be picking up on while witnessing like this third-party interaction, sort of? You know, is there any expressions, behaviors that they look for? But, you know, if you don't know, what do you think they look at then?
Yeah, so the social interactions the dogs were observing were very complex. We don't know exactly what the dogs are picking on, but we have our suspects. And one thing that likely helps them is the direction of the gaze. So the fact that their owners are looking at the toy and then they're shifting their gaze and looking at the other person. We know that with children, this moment where two people are looking at each other and then shifting together their attention to the thing that they're talking about is really important for the kids, because this is kind of what establish the fact that they are talking about the same thing. So it's not only the gaze shift, but it's also the coordination of shifting the gaze together simultaneously to whatever we're talking about. So the gaze shift might be something very important to them. It might also be things like the pauses in their speech, the way they intonate some of the words, the speed of the speech. These are all things that might be helping the dogs to figure out what is going on.
So with these certain breeds that were used, you know, which they might be known to be maybe just slightly more intelligent than others in certain areas of their department, but what qualities of those breeds in particular do you think aid them to possibly, you know, kind of have that sort of ability to label learn? Are there any qualities? Because each dog has their own strengths, right? But these ones specifically, these, I guess, a small portion of these dogs, do you know of any qualities or something that could possibly aid them in this department for label learning?
Yeah, so because it's not a breed specific trait, we can't say, oh, this breed is really good at that, so this breed is doing that. But what we can say is that these dogs are normally motivated to play with toys. They really care about the toys. And I think they just seem to have fun with it. This seems to be something that both the dogs and the owners enjoy. And I think that's probably the key component here.
Wow. So sort of like a bonding sort of thing. So they're happy. And so therefore they might pay more attention to that, right?
I think it's the situation is reinforcing for them. So it's something that they enjoy doing. And we also see that the natural situation where these dogs learn is just when they are playing with their owners. In fact, most of the dog owners tell me they didn't intend to teach their dogs the names of toys. They were just playing with their dogs, and one day they noticed that the dog has learned the names of the toys.
Wow. And so do these dogs and even the toddlers that overhear and learn these words pick up on them? Are there any similarities when it comes to picking up on them? Can we draw any similarities from the way that both human toddlers and these dogs learn these words? Are there any similarities or even differences?
So what we see here is that the surface level behavior is the same, right? They're both learning from overhearing. They're both doing it as good as they were if you were directly teaching them. But we don't know if the cognitive processes that power this, so what's going underneath the hood, is that the same? It's most likely not the same. And I think that's something we always need to remember. When we see animals and humans interact in what might look the same, they're probably thinking very different thoughts.
So just how rare is this skill for dogs? Knowing that it it kind of isn't for humans. It's sort of something that we all do, right? But for dogs, it's not. So I'm wondering, is this like such a rare skill for that species?
We don't know how rare it is, but we do know that we've been searching for these dogs for about 7 years now. And across the entire world, so far, we've only found about 45. But if you're listening to us and you think, oh, but my dog can easily learn the names of toys, then please reach out. I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, the more the merrier, right? We would love to know if they could do that. So what fascinates you personally the most about this research for you? What fascinates you?
For me, it's the ease in which these dogs are learning. They are incredible in the way they learn. And also, you see how confident they are in their choices. They sometimes, like, they perform almost 100%. So, and I'm astonished by how easily and how good they're doing this. And yeah, and honestly, I just enjoy seeing them play with their toys.
And then finally, my last question is, what do you plan on researching next into this topic, or maybe another topic as well?
So I'm really interested to understand what exactly in the social interaction the dogs are picking up on, and what are they paying attention to? I think that would really help us to better understand these dogs and, yeah, better understand dogs in general.
Shani Dror is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Veterinary Medicine in Vienna. Her research is published in the journal Science. Dror spoke with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcast.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1840. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.